Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hello, everybody. It's Andrew Schiff once again in the New York City office of Euro Pacific Capital. Once again, Peter couldn't make it because of political commitments. That's the way it's going. The convention is next month. The Connecticut senatorial, the Connecticut Republican convention is next month. So he's kind of in a lot of ways in the thick of things right now. Got to make a big showing at the convention. Got to wrap up a lot of support before then. So that's what he's doing. Someone's at the door here at our New York City office, ringing the bell loudly. Anyway, so it's Andrew Schiff today, and I noticed that in the intro it says that Peter has a passion for truth. I wonder what I could have a passion for. If he's a passion for truth guy, maybe I could be the passion for justice guy, or maybe the passion for the American way guy. I'm not sure. Should probably look at it and come up with a slogan for myself. Anyway, if you want to give us a call, 888-678-9597. Give us a call, 888-678-9597. I see the lines are open. Usually they're all filled at this point, so the door is open. Big news for me today, at least. This was the first day that our new book, or Peter and I's new book, How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes, is really out in a big way. A lot of our followers here at Euro Pacific Capital may know we did send out an email to our database yesterday alerting people that the book was out, with providing a link to Amazon. And as testament to the efficacy of those emails, the book jumped up from like it was in the 400 range of Amazon. Amazon ranks all their books in terms of where the sales are, number one through number 16 million, apparently. We were up at number 300 or 400 before the email went out, and afterwards we jumped straight up to number 15 of all books. Today we got as high as 9, which is really amazing. We're up there with just the pulp novels and the James Patterson and Stieg Larsson books and some of the Twilight series books. And then there's, Peter Schiff and Andrew Schiff and How an Economy Grows. So that's very, very exciting for me and for Peter. And obviously, these Amazon moves don't really say that much. It really comes down to, what it does in bookstores. But obviously, we think the feedback that I've gotten from a few people, I got a couple of fan mail calls today. People seem to be enjoying it. A couple of people have gotten their book, so they're actually reading it, and they really seem to enjoy it. So I think it could be a big book. If it stays up on top of these Amazon charts, more people will see it. More people will buy it. Reviewers will review it. Maybe the press will start taking my calls. There are a number of people in the talk radio world whose names I won't name, who I've been trying to contact, and who are the leading lights in the conservative talk show world, who you think would be tickled to death by a book like this. We hopefully they'll get behind it and talk about it and give it the push that it deserves, because I think it's the one book that's come out that has the ability to teach basic conservative Austrian school economics to lay people in a simple, direct, engaging, fun way. And none of these other books can do that. I'm not saying this is the ultimate work of scholarship, or it's the be all and end all of literary achievement. It's not, but it is unique in what it does, teaching in an engaging and funny way. People can read it in 2 hours. You can give it to your teenagers, give it to your mother-in-law, your father-in-law, what have you. And I think it's great, and I think it's off to a great start. Yahoo Tech Ticker, which is the video service of Yahoo Finance, did a piece about the book today, which was nice. They ran some of the illustrations, and they gave Peter about 5 minutes to speak about it. Hopefully more of that will be in the future. But for now, I'm, again, tickled pink that it's up as high as it is. Anyway, so moving on to the news of the day. The big news, it was yesterday's news, but it was so interesting. It was riveting. We were watching it on CNBC. And by the way, CNBC's production costs for the day were pretty much rock bottom. All they needed was a live feed from the Senate floor, and they had their programming for the entire day. But you were watching the Senate Banking Committee grill, I hate to say the poor slobs from Goldman Sachs, because, of course, these people are probably the richest and smartest people in the room. But it didn't look like anybody would want to be those guys, especially some of those younger guys who were forced to defend their actions against, in particular, I mean, Senator Carl Levin was just giddy with grilling these people. And it was, you know, good theater, public flogging of Goldman Sachs, which clearly, I mean, Goldman Sachs is just in the thick of all this double dealing, and certainly they probably should have been, gone belly up, of course, a couple of years ago. There's plenty of guilt to go around over there, but let's face facts. Goldman Sachs did not create the financial crisis, and certainly this testimony and this day of hearings was meant to convey that the source of the financial crisis laid in the details of these structured products and these mortgage-backed securities that Goldman Sachs was selling. And I mean, at one point, I think one of the senators said, "You guys created the housing bubble," which is just absurd. I mean, and also they were trying to, this is kind of inside baseball for a lot of people, but they were trying to get Goldman Sachs to say that they should have had more of a responsibility or had a fiduciary duty in letting the clients or people that were buying these packaged products to let them know that they were actually taking the opposite position in those securities, when no such requirement exists, nor should it really. I mean, the problem is that Goldman Sachs, and believe me, I have no sympathy whatsoever for Goldman Sachs, but the fact is that they engage in market-making activities, and they engage in originating activities, and they engage in investment activities. So there's a huge corporation. As a market maker, and that was a lot of these guys were on there as being market makers, these are people just handle the traffic. They buy and they find, they match up buyers and sellers. They have no obligation to you. I mean, if I'm a stockbroker, I mean, I have a suitability requirement, but even less. I mean, I don't, if you call me up and say, "I want to buy this stock, this is what I want," I don't have the obligation to talk you out of it, if that's what you want to do. And in that situation, Goldman Sachs, as a market maker, is even in less of an obligation than I am as a broker-dealer. And, you know, they do have an obligation not to lie to you, and they have different obligations from their origination business when they actually structure the products. But the senators were well aware of the regulatory landscape, but they were making theater. I think what happened with Goldman Sachs, which is what this lawsuit's about, I think Goldman Sachs actively lied and committed fraud in structuring these products and not telling people that, oh, yeah, we structured these products, with the case of the ones that Henry Paulson wanted, specifically to fail. So, you know, these are the you know, crappiest, and actually one of the senators used a worse word than that, which I won't repeat. Although I do in my private life, can you believe that? That in the case of this particular Paulson product, I think it was Abacus it was called, they actually constructed it specifically to fail, because that's what Paulson wanted in the product. Now, if they're not disclosing that, that's clearly fraud. But in the case of a market maker, you don't have that obligation. And one of the things that they were talking about, and I had mentioned this last week, was it looked like one of the issues in the financial regulatory bill, which, by the way, is cleared some log jams in the Senate and will now be moving to a public debate, is an effort possibly to require to act as fiduciaries for their clients, much like investment advisors do. If that's the case, that will have a lot of ramifications for our business, a lot of ramifications for the way average investors want to go ahead and, you know, and especially self-directed investors, how you handle your own business. It can affect, the government can essentially put on some handcuffs on how you can dispose of your own assets. So it's got a lot of implications. But, you know, just first of all, getting back to the Goldman, I mean, again, Goldman and their brethren in Wall Street who package these products up were packaging up mortgages. The mortgages themselves, and the reason why we had so many mortgages to begin with, was not because of Goldman Sachs. It was because of the Fed. It was because of the regulatory bias that existed in Washington with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the FHA and the low interest rates. I mean, the federal government was the reason why there were so many mortgages to package to begin with in the first place. And again, we've said this thousands of times that, yes, Wall Street got drunk and did stupid things. Clearly they did, but it was the Federal Reserve and it was Fannie and Freddie that got them liquored up in the first place. And the entire hearing, nowhere in the hearing did they mention low interest rates. Did they mention moral hazard? Did they mention the policy aims of the Clinton and Bush administration to promote home ownership through countless government incentives, both tax incentives and other types of incentives to buy homes? So, you know, it's and then of course with Goldman, I mean, they're primarily dealing with other sophisticated large institutional investors who are certainly don't need to be protected or counseled on how what kind of investment decisions to make. These are big boys, so it's really kind of a farcical event, and I think it's just going to get worse over time. Anyway, other big news of the day, of course, was the Fed came out with their new decision, and these are getting. I mean, it's like. I remember a day not too long ago when there was actually changes in every subsequent Fed decision, when they were actually anticipated with some type of, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? And that was what primarily gave CNBC its storyline for from week to week. They would say, what's the Fed going to do? And these Fed watchers. Now everybody knows what the Fed's going to do. It's the most boring period of Fed watching I can remember, and I've been doing it for like 10 years. The statement never changes. Not even slightly, and they're keeping interest. The only part that's interesting now is although they're not changing their policy, and they're keeping interest rates at 0.25%, and they will keep it so for an indefinite period or for an extended time. I forget the actual words. Is that above that they start talking about all the good economic results that they're seeing recently about consumer activity, about being restored health of the credit markets, about the housing market stabilizing, and all these good things. And then they say, oh, by the way, but we're not even thinking of perhaps raising interest rates, which if that was the case, if the economy were, in fact, improving, they still telegraph no desire to raise interest rates, that should be killing the dollar and forcing interest rates higher. And, in fact, the 10-year note is creeping up a little bit higher. It flirted with 4%, which was a key barrier about a month ago, and it seems like it's turning back in that direction. But I think what happens is that right now the Fed is getting a get-out-of-jail-free card and by the fact that all of the world's attention is now focused across the Atlantic at the Eurozone and Greece and now Portugal and Spain, who are looks like they're entering some kind of debt spiral. Nouriel Roubini said famously today that by this time next week there might not even be a euro. That makes for a nice soundbite. I don't think that's going to happen, but... everyone understands that they're starting to understand that that Greece was in worse shape than everyone thought. They got downgraded to junk by the ratings agencies, again, closing the barn door after the horses have left. That's what they do. They also downgraded Portugal and Spain. I think just Portugal. I don't know about Spain. And that caused the Portuguese stock market to sell for about 6% in one day. So this is obviously something that is starting to spread. It could potentially spell the end of the euro or eurozone, and it's causing the euro to tank, interest rates in many places in Europe to go up. So by comparison, Fed policy and the U.S. dollar looks stable and safe for the moment. I see one of the things I did a little bit of math before the show started. There's all kinds of, if you know that the European Community and the International Monetary Fund put together a $50 billion bailout package for Greece. But now some of the economists are saying that it's going to be a lot more if necessary to bail them out. And the figures range from about $120 billion to $200 billion. I did the math. And I think the population of Greece is about 10 million people. And if you look at a per capita debt basis for the United States and Greece, we're actually not that far off. It's pretty close. I forget the exact numbers, but I've seen them per capita debt and percentage GDP to debt is pretty close for Greece and the United States. So if these economists are assuming that it's going to take Greece anywhere from $120 billion to $200 billion to successfully bail them out, that would translate into about a $4.5 trillion bailout for the United States if we were in similar circumstances. So that was pretty interesting. That continues to situation continues to unfold, and every day is a little bit different. I can't imagine where it's going to go to now. Of course, the Germans are on the spot. The German elections are coming up. A lot of the German the parties are positioning themselves. It's not popular in Germany to be seen as being a bailer out of Greek profligacy. So there is some. If it wasn't an election year, the Germans probably be a little bit more helpful to the Greeks. But they're trying to. There's some swing elections that could tip the balance in Germany. So it's very complicated. Just moving along the other news today, I want to get to a different topic that is a little different for the show, but I'd also a couple of other little quick items that I thought were interesting. Visa, the credit card company, announced their earnings today, and of course they were up strongly. Americans are spending. Americans aren't making any more, of course, but they are spending, and the profits are very strong at Visa. Which, of course, we don't think that's a good thing. We think that Americans should not be spending as much as they have, because they should be saving more to help repair our economy in the future, which is a topic explored at length in my new book, How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes. On a political front, I found it interesting that Charlie Crist in Florida announced that he's going to be running as a independent. It just amazes me the way politicians just can't give up power. They'll do anything to stay in office. So the thing I wanted to mention, which is before I go to the callers, was a little off topic. I've been just finishing up a book on Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow. It came out a couple of years ago, and it's just a fantastic book, the biography of Alexander Hamilton. And just, you know, Hamilton's a very controversial figure among Austrians, among libertarians, people who believe that the federal government is far too encroachive and dominating, and he deserves a reputation. But at the same time, some of the things this book has taught me is, first of all, it gives you an incredible appreciation of what Hamilton did as a person, regardless of whether you think that he was the American Mephistopheles or if he was the grand architect of what became a great country in the world. Just what he achieved here, where he came from. He was born in the West Indies from a very kind of unfortunate, dubious family. He was accused of being a bastard child, illegitimate. He was essentially orphaned by the age of 12. He had other problems. His family was of minor gentry, minor nobility. There was no reason to believe that he would ever do anything in his life. And he ended up just by fortune and fate coming to the United States at age 18, primarily because of a hurricane in the Caribbean, which he wrote an essay about the hurricane, which caught the attention of the entire island, and they raised a fund to send him to the United States. But through his own efforts, he quickly became, he was in the right place at the right time. 2 years later, the Revolutionary War started, and he was very active in it. A soldier became, he raised his own company in New York when he was going to college here, an artillery company. He was in the right place at the right time. He got on George Washington's staff when he was just 19 years old, 20 years old. George Washington made him his primary aide-de-camp and is essentially his chief of staff for the remainder of the Revolutionary War. And then on and on, of course, Hamilton becomes the Secretary of Treasury. It was clear that Washington appreciated his talents more than anybody else, and he became, you know, a very influential human being, probably one of the more influential human beings of the 18th, 19th century. But the thing is that the interesting part of it, and this is something to talk about when you're having debates on the subject of whether or not Hamilton was great or Hamilton was evil, clearly when you read the book, you can see that Hamilton definitely wanted the central government to be much more active. although he was one of the framers of the Constitution, and he was helped draft the Constitution, push it through the authorship of the Federalist Papers. You know, it's amazing how quickly he wanted the federal government's power to be expanded, and how he saw the Constitution as a very, very loose document. He really believed in the implied powers of the Constitution, and he envisioned many, many things. You always think, well, the founding fathers, they envisioned the country like this. Well, in fact, they didn't. Some of them didn't. A lot of the founding fathers, were happy to use the Constitution very loosely. In fact, when you look at the Alien and Sedition Acts that were passed in the Adams administration, they were incredibly restrictive and flew in the face of all the freedoms that we as Americans hold dear. And these are from the founding generation. Now, at the same time, you could say, well, the Republicans were right. The Republicans under Jefferson, fortunately, they kicked the Federalists out of power. They stifled Hamilton's ambitions, and the Federalist Party splintered. And the Republicans came in, and they were small government, legislative branch, and they were in power for 30 years, up until, through the 1820s and 30s. Well, that's not necessarily the case in terms of, when Jefferson came in, he didn't believe in executive power, but the Louisiana Purchase of 1803 was a stunning, stunning usurpation of executive power that none of the Federalists in the Adams or Jefferson administration, Washington or Adams administration, had tried. And it's arguable that Jefferson, the big states' rights guy, anti-federalist guy, with his purchase of Louisiana, set a precedent that was far more dangerous in terms of loosely interpreting the Constitution than anything that Hamilton would have thought of. But the real important part is this. Yes, Hamilton asked for, and people like him say, we have to have a strong federal government. And libertarians say that's evil, and I agree. I think we shouldn't have that. You should have a more decentralized country. But they were saying, and this is the counter argument, that we had an experiment in liberty in this country that needed protection. If the strong central government people hadn't have prevailed in the 1780s and 90s through the assumption of state debts and other things, it's very possible, in fact, it's very probable that the country would have splintered apart, if not then, probably by the 1830s in the nullification crisis of the Jackson administration. And this was Hamilton's argument. If we don't have a strong enough government to keep the country together, and the country splits apart, then tyrannies will arise. Sectionalism, factionalism, strong men, dictatorships will arise. There'll be warfare. There'll be no centralized policy, and people will lose all of the benefits of stability that a single country provides. And certainly Europe provides lots of, and other countries in the world, parts of the world, provide lots of illustrations for that. So he was saying, we need to have, if we're not strong enough, we'll fall apart, and then we'll cannibalize each other. So we have to be strong. At the same time, what's the good of a union that has to force someone to stay in? These are very difficult questions. I don't have any answers, but I urge you to explore them. You know, there's books out about Hamilton that lionize him and demonize him. Read them both. See what you get up with, what conclusions you draw. Anyway, so let's go to the phones. Who do we got here? Who's on the phone the longest? Looks like Matt in Kentucky is the winner by a second. Hi, Matt. How you doing?
Hey, Andrew.
How's it going?
Pretty good. Congratulations on the book.
No, but thank you. Thank you. It feels good.
Well, yeah, I've got a quick question for you. I've actually just got a job with AT&T, and I'm probably starting out making around $30,000 a year. And I'm 22 years old, so I've never contributed to a 401k. My question is, should I take advantage of
You say you're 22?
Yes.
So you're 22?
Yes.
Okay.
So should I get the 401k, or should I just take the money and invest it with Europac, or just buy some precious metals?
Well,
or like that?
It depends on the quality of the 401k. I mean, the good thing about the 401k is it does give you free money. If they don't have a match, then especially with the kind of salary you're earning, and no disrespect there, but you can set up a personal IRA, and on the personal IRA, I forget the exact figure. It's something like $5,000 a year. So even if you withheld your money through the 401k, you probably wouldn't get to $5,000 a year. So if they're not offering you a match, and I would say even a generous match, you can get the same tax benefits essentially by just taking your money and opening up an IRA at a place like Euro Pacific Capital, for instance, or some other brokerage firm if you so choose, and then you can deduct contribute up to $4,800, I think, per person per year, and then you get the same tax down. You'd be able to deduct that from your taxes. Of course, you wouldn't get a match. We're not going to give you a matching any money like your employer might through a 401k. So if you look at the employer's 401k, and they give you, let's say, a 50% match or a 30% match, sometimes it's even more than that. And I think probably AT&T is probably pretty generous as a big corporation.
Right.
So if that's the case, well, you can't really walk away from that. The only question is, okay, well, then they're going to have the money. Your money's going to be in their 401k plan. So, you know, how can you invest it? Now, they should have investment choices that are fairly broad. You should be able to pick and choose among mutual funds that suit your interest, and you should be able to direct the investments as you see fit. Now, they're going to try to tell you what's suitable for you, and they're going to have some guy from benefits who's going to tell you all about what the ideal of portfolio is going to be, and you're not going to listen to them because you have other ideas, or if you want. I mean, it's up to you. But if, let's suppose you wanted more exposure to foreign stocks, maybe you want exposure to precious metals, it's possible. They have funds like that that can give you commodities, that can give you foreign exposure, probably not commodities, but certainly foreign exposure. And you might be able to structure your portfolio in a manner that's fairly consistent with what we would do here. Maybe not exactly, but close. And if they're giving you free money, which we're not giving you, then you're probably better off staying there.
Right. Yeah, they will match it at some point. So.
Excuse me?
So, yeah, they will match it. I'm not sure exactly how much, but
well that you got to find out, and the things you got to find out is how much they're going to match, and then B, what kind of investment options they'll offer you. Because you know at most, let's say if you're making $32,000, and the most you're going to save the most you're going to save is 6%, something like that, which is a lot actually. You can save 6%. That's $2,000 a year. So you can take that same $2,000 and open an IRA, and you get the same tax benefit. The question is, you know, we're not going to offer the match. So if the match is 10%, I would say that's, you know, it's not that significant. Even 20% might be that significant, depending on the decision. Because with a brokerage firm, you could pick exactly what you want. But for those big matches, then you've got a harder decision to make.
Right.
Okay. But it's up to you to really research it. Okay. Good luck to you, Matt. Okay. Let's go to Terry in Courtney, Canada.
Hello,
Terry.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Where is Courtney, Canada?
Vancouver Island.
Vancouver Island. Wow. Near Victoria, I imagine.
Yep. Very, very, very west coast. Yeah.
Yeah. I was there once when I was just 17 years old in Victoria. Was I going to say, we always get a lot of Canadian callers. We get a lot of, we are hoping to open Euro Pacific Canada in the near future for all you Canadian investors out there who wanted to do business with a firm like ours. We'll certainly be sending information out as it comes forward, but we have a couple of guys that are working very hard to set up a affiliated company they'll own the company, but it'll be a branch in Canada, hopefully this year. So that's good news for all you Canadian listeners out there. So what can I do for you, Terry?
Yeah, well, one of the reasons your show is interesting to me is because you do get Canadian callers, and we see our, you know, they say when you guys roll over, it squishes us. So we're very interested in what goes on there because it directly impacts us. I had a question. I know you don't give out advice on investments, but a couple of years ago, I followed the James Dines letter, and it was crowing about uranium, and it said that uranium was in short supply and heavy demand, et cetera, and that if it ever did drop, it'd be it dropped the least. He was even correct about the real estate crash, but he said that uranium would drop the least and it would recover the quickest. Well.
Was it the case? I don't think that was the case.
No, it was the exactly opposite. It fell the furthest, and it's one of the only things that has never come back.
Oops, it did never really. Uranium has never really come back. Although you would think that with the the Obama administration, being more warming up to nuclear power. Other nations around the world are also not warming up to nuclear power. I know nothing about the dynamics of the uranium industry. But I would certainly think, just from a broad perspective, right now there's probably the most favorable favorable regulatory consideration of nuclear power than I can remember seeing in 30 years. I don't know what it's like in Canada, probably the same.
Well, that's what got me in. It was a compelling story, and I bought into it hook, line, and sinker, and really got smacked. On the gold question, other newsletters have been telling us to wait for a drop since May of last year. It's been a year now, and I've been in quite a bit of cash, and watching the gold stocks kind of go up and gold go up. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering, are you on the side of the people that think it's gonna have a pretty big pullback because it's just been going up so steadily?
I don't think so. Because look, gold today went to 11, I think closed at 1171. Oil is up to 83. I don't know how much that has to do with if that oil big fire explosion in the Gulf had anything to do with it. Clearly all the inflation that we're creating by central banks around the world and here, it's there, and it's a big issue. The government likes to say there's no inflation, but take a look at the price of gold and take a look at the price of oil. Now, gold, if you recall, went up to about $1,200 an ounce. That's its high in this current move. That's the high of its all-time high, but I'm thinking more in inflation-adjusted terms. So I kind of look at the all-time high for gold at 2,000, if you adjust for the 1980 price. But in this current move, it was $1,200 was the high. So it got up that high, and that was like 5 months ago or more. And since then, it's pulled back to about 1050. On a couple of occasions, once or twice, and sometimes it fell pretty quickly. And I thought, my God, it's going to get to 1,000, and then it might pull back to 900. But it never did; never got close. And I think if you look at the chart for gold, and you look at the way the world is operating, of course the Chinese are adding to their gold positions now. They're talking it down at the same time, but I don't think their policy has changed. The Chinese are slowly, and if there's an article we posted on our website today that details some of the things that China is doing, clearly to seed the soil to for a renminbi-based world. They're making small administrative changes, small financial regulatory changes here and there that will create the conditions for a post-dollar world. And I think they probably assume that gold will be a bigger part of the post-dollar world. So there's plenty of demand for gold, plenty of inflation being created. Gold's not going to go up in a straight line. If you look at the chart, I don't think you're going to see a pullback. I think there's been plenty of attempts for a pullback, and there's plenty of support for gold. There's plenty of support for gold at 1050. So here we are at 1171, and we've been there for, I think the next move, I think we're going to see 1300 before we see 1,000.
So that's when do you think, following a couple of newsletters, and they've sort of each been half right. Of course, I've been on the wrong half. When is it going to be this year that Euro Capital sets up in Canada? Or
I think so, yeah. I mean, I can't promise, but that's the plan. And again, it's a separate company. It's a firm that's going to, it likes our style and wants to mimic our style, but for regulatory reasons, it's very difficult for us to do business with Canadians.
On the topic of newsletters, do you think those are? I guess those are competing with you, so you don't really comment.
The newsletters are a very different business model. I mean, they can say a lot more than we can because they're not selling stocks. They're just offering advice, and they're not making a transaction for you. So as a result, they have a very different business model, and it's also they can be a lot more wild and woolly in what they say because it's freedom of speech. As a business, we're actually in the business of buying and selling stocks for customers and dispensing, to a certain extent, some advice. And that puts us under a whole different umbrella. Let me go to my – thanks for the call. Let me go for some other callers. Let me just say this. Steve and Micah, you're definitely getting – I'm gonna get to one of you two guys. You've been on call for 30. But then we have empty lines after that. So I encourage anyone to pick up. I'm going to get to my next two callers. but then there's some time on the other end. So call 888-678-9597. 888-678-9597. Here's your chance to speak to the One Million Andrew Schiff. I didn't really mean that. So anyway, let's go to, I think Steve wins by 10 seconds. Steve in New York, how you doing?
Hey, Andrew, how you doing? Thanks for doing the show. You always do a good job in Peter's absence.
Thank you. What part of New York are you in?
I'm in Manhattan.
Oh, well, I'm in Manhattan, too. It's a local call.
Two of us and 8 million others. I'm a big fan of your guys. You know, I'm a subscriber to Austrian Economics. And there's just one thing I've always sort of had a question with in your guys and Peter's philosophy about when he compares the U.S. to other developed countries. And I don't know if he still maintains, but for a while was talking about how the U.S. is in much worse shape even than Europe, the U.K., and Japan, mm-hmm. fiscally in worse shape. And it's hard for me to understand that because our government debt load is actually in many cases lower in a lot of those countries, and they've got the same unfunded liabilities problem that we have, and even worse demographics than we have there.
There aren't too many people. There aren't too many countries that have a higher debt load in terms of debt to GDP, and also per capita debt, and also we have a huge unfunded liability too in terms of Social Security and Medicare that are going to be going bankrupt soon. And then when you throw in our trade deficit, I know that ours are pretty significant. You throw in, I mean, Europe still has a positive balance of trade. Japan has a huge debt problem too, but they owe most of their debt to themselves. You know, we owe most of our debt to foreigners. And then we have a huge trade deficit, which makes our situation particularly precarious. Plus, you know, we kind of rely on the fact that our own currency is the reserve. So we're particularly vulnerable to a change in status where we're no longer the reserve currency.
Right. Those things are true. The trade deficit, you know, ours is worse than any of them, but just in terms of demographics, Japan is probably in the worst shape. They're aging faster than anybody.
And the other issues are these. I mean, we have huge. We are more addicted to credit than anybody else. We have probably more credit in our society than anybody else. So we need to borrow to keep our economy going, and we need to borrow cheaply. And
sure. And
that's more pronounced here than I think. I mean, there are probably other small countries that have that look as bad. But I mean, we're a huge country. And we have those problems. So maybe not, you know, on a one-for-one basis, you could probably find some bigger offenders. But when you put the whole package together, you know, and then we have this, you know, this incredibly bloated, military-industrial complex and things like, and an empire around the world that other countries don't have. I mean, we're particularly vulnerable.
Sure. You know, I don't think it necessarily matters to the thesis about gold going higher. I think that's independent of the U.S. relative to other countries. I think all these countries are going to blow up. It doesn't matter who's worse than the other, really. But I just never sort of understood that particular point. So, you know, I'm with you on gold.
There's going to be a big change. I mean, I don't think there's going to be all the countries are going to be in trouble, but there's still going to be – everything is relative. We're not going to forget how to make it. Right now, the world has incredible capacity to make things. And that's all you really need to make things, and to make things efficiently is all you really need to create wealth. And that's not going to go away.
Sure.
So the beautiful thing about human ingenuity is once you learn how to do something, you don't forget. And this is actually also kind of explained in the book. I don't mean to keep unplugging it, but it is. So, you know, all of the advancements that we've made as a species, even if we have a financial crisis and there's some terrible thing happening, you know, it's not the financial industry that made us wealthy. It's the fact that we can produce stuff relatively efficiently, and we'll still be able to do that afterwards. I'm talking about the world itself. So
it's just the currencies that are going to blow up, not the countries.
The currencies can blow up. The financialism could, you know, we can enter a, you know, a real global down period for a small amount of time. But the point is that, you know, Peter's not, and I'm not pessimistic about, you know, somehow we're going to see some dystopia or the whole world's going to start crumbling, because we don't think of it that way. I mean, we'll get to a more sustainable financial system, and there'll be some people will rise and some people will fall. There'll be a rearrangement of the chairs and the musical chairs that we're playing, and the rich countries now might not be as rich, but globally, the economy will still expand, because so far, and most of economic history is a one-way street. You build on innovation, you build on invention, and you become more efficient. As long as the general tenets of free market capitalism survive to a certain extent, and I think they will, then things will improve. And sure. as long as the world doesn't completely devolve into a command economy, which I don't think it's going to. Let's go to anything else, Steve?
No, that's, I appreciate your comments. I agree with you on all those points. So thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Thanks a lot. Okay, let's go with Mika in Ohio, patiently waiting for 37 minutes.
Hi, Andrew.
How you doing, Mika?
This is Micah.
Is it Micah,
Micah
or Mika?
Yeah, it's Micah.
Micah. How you doing, Micah?
Good. Thank you for taking my call, Andrew.
I am
a client of Euro-Pacific, and I've been following your guys' investment strategy for a couple years now, and I wholeheartedly agree with it.
Consider investment risks carefully before you invest. There's risks in foreign stocks. There's currency risk, and read the prospectus well before investing, and go take a look at the prospectus. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Can we talk about? I know that Peter has said in the past that I think maybe you hit the big nail on the head for me. He has talked about, well, let's invest in specific companies as opposed to broadly diversifying. And I always kind of took it that a mutual fund was more of a broad diversification.
It is.
Okay.
It is. So it's not right for everybody. I mean, some people come in and they really want concentration. Some people really want that. And you know that if you've been a Euro Pacific Capital client for a couple of years now, you've seen the roller coaster.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know that's not right for everyone. Can't, that's if you invest in a few stocks, you're going to get concentration. You're going to get volatility. And that's right for some people, and it's not right for others. We're not pushing everybody into the same box. And as we grow as a firm, I think it's just, you know, we have to have that flexibility. But at the same time, we're trying to, you know, make the product to be sensitive to our needs. But again, read the prospectus carefully. There's plenty of risks in investing in a mutual fund.
That's right.
Did you hear that, regulars? Any other question that you might have?
Well, actually, one other thing I've been curious about is, reading the books and Peter's analogy of the caboose, the United States is going to detach from China, and they're going to take off when everything goes south. The one thing I have worried a little bit about with that philosophy is I'm hearing that there may be bubbles in real estate, say, in China, or that China is creating other bubbles of its own. And I wonder if those kind of things are things that are real, and if there's something that we should be concerned about, or what your feelings are.
I mean, from what I've heard, there may be a real estate bubble in certain places in China, places like Shanghai and in Guangzhou in the south are getting very, very hot, and you know there's some of the prices you've seen are pretty frothy. At the same time, the whole idea is that the fundamental caboose idea is it's clear they are essentially selling us their products below cost. They're manipulating the currency to give us a better deal on their products. They are depressing the purchasing power of their own citizens in order to transfer the purchasing power to our citizens. They're lending us their savings. They don't have any. They don't have credit in America. There's no such thing as consumer credit in China. They pay for everything in cash. They pay for the medical services in cash up front. You want me to operate? Give me the cash. They pay for their schools up front. Kids show up with handfuls of cash when they go to school. There's no retirement. You save for your retirement. They don't have credit. Why don't they have credit? They save 30% of their money. Why do they not have credit? Well, they lend all the credit to us. So our point is that they give us their products below cost, essentially. They manipulate their currency to transfer the purchasing power to us, and they give us their savings. So they don't have the credit available for their own businesses to use and to lend. So without having to do all those things, they would be better off economically. Their own living standards would rise. Now, that doesn't mean that there might be pockets of bubble-like activity in China. It's a very hot economy because there were years of pent-up demand because they were for years depressed below their potential by a ridiculous economic system. They have a natural they naturally have a lot of the things that would create an economy to be create economic conditions. They have cohesion, they have stability at home. They've got a very long history of entrepreneurial activity, and they were poor, and they didn't want to be poor, and the world had passed them by, and they're doing what they can. So it caught fire, and we think there's a long way for them to go. If you look at the per capita living standards compared to ours, it's still, you know, one-fifth of what we are, or less. So they've got a long way to go. That doesn't mean there's not going to be fits and starts, there's not going to be bubbles here and there. But I don't see the Chinese economy becoming derailed. It's just all the things they need are there, and you know they're not going to go away.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Michael. We've got three more callers. I want to get to all three of them. Let's go to John in Virginia.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
No problem, John.
What do you think about shorting 30-year Treasury securities, and when do you think that's going to be a good time to do?
I don't want to give investment advice over the phone, but I will say, you know, there's probably ways to do that if you want to do that. I know there's some ETFs. I know that I had shorted. I bought one of these ETFs a couple of years ago, thinking that it was going to go down, and you know, I sat on those for a while, didn't make any money because they didn't go down. I think over time, certainly, 30-year Treasury yields will have to go up. I mean, one of the reasons that the Fed's not borrowing at the long end of the curve right now, so the U.S. government's not borrowing at the long end, so the yields are a lot lower than they should be if the Fed were actually, you know, trying to finance the 30-year paper. But eventually those yields are going to have to go higher. You know, it's up to you as an investor if you want to take a position like that. It could pay off in the future. It might take a long time. As you know, the markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. That's the old maxim. In the meantime, you make an investment like that, you're not getting paid. It's not really an investment. It's a speculation that something's going to happen. And we think it's going to happen. We have no idea when. When you make an investment in a company, you see that, okay, it's actually doing something in the here and now. Even if I'm not right, exactly about the macroeconomic picture, we see this company's doing something. It's making money. It's paying a dividend. I don't have to be right. You know, I can make money even if I'm not 100% right, because there's something a little more tangible about it. So, I mean, you can make those kind of investments, and it's great when you're right. But when you're wrong and the timing's wrong, it's kind of like, you know, like buying an option. You know, you could be right about a company, and you buy an option that the company's going to go up, and maybe, you know, you can make a lot of money if it does. But if it doesn't go up at the right time, you don't make anything. And those kind of ETFs are like that. If you're not right at the right time, you're just sitting there, spinning your wheels. So, yeah, I can't say I don't want to, you know, make up your mind for you. Do I think that over time, the 30-year Treasury yields will go higher, the bond prices will fall? Absolutely. I do think that. I don't know when it's going to happen. I think the laws of physics will apply, but I can't say exactly when. So you got to take that into consideration when you think about investments like that.
All right. And I also saw that Jim Rogers is long the euro now. What do you think about that?
That might be a good call. I don't know. I mean, the euro's gotten beaten up. You know, Peter said the best thing, you know, if the euro were to all of a sudden, if the eurozone were to cut off Greece and say, look, you know, we're not going to debase our currency to, you know, you guys, you know, burn your own house and you have to come up with your own solution. By the way, in some of these solutions, I've seen the haircuts have been talking about 20 or 30% restructuring of their bonds to make Greece whole. But if they do that, I think there'll be a short-term political cost for Europe. But I think if that happens, then that will strengthen the euro, because it'll show that the euro does have integrity, and the Germans in particular are not going to start bailing out everybody who needs a bailout, and then the euro could recover. So it might be a pretty canny play by Jim Rogers. It's always hard to make these kind of things. I mean, you go into a market and you can see all the bad things, and you're not looking at the good things. And, the euro could, the problem is that even if the euro cracks apart, it's not like you invest in the euro else and you get nothing. I mean, you'll get something else. And maybe you can just take your euro and you have euros, and then you have Deutschmarks if the Deutschmark comes back. It's not like it's not like it's going to be a stock that goes to zero. That's not the way it's going to work. So maybe he's crazy like a fox. Anyway, so let's running out of time. Let's go to Ramon in Florida. And Mike, I'll get you in D.C. too. So hold on. How you doing, Ramon?
How you doing? I had a couple of questions. And I think we've been talking a lot about China today, and I'm just trying to grasp the concept of the yuan appreciating a little bit. So I want to see if you could kind of clear it up for me. If the yuan appreciates, is China concerned that their exports are going to decrease?
And yes.
And then would America, so that yuan increases and America's exports would increase as well?
Well, yeah. The whole idea is if their yuan increases in value, then their exports would become less competitive overseas, and our exports to them would be more competitive. Although I think the American exports are secondary. They think that if the yuan goes up, they'll lose their export. Their exporters will take a hit.
How will that drive? So right now it's kind of odd right now. I've been watching gold and silver, and it seems like gold is rising a little bit. And usually they trend the same way. Is that now? I've actually seen last few days, probably the last week and a half, that they've actually kind of done the inverse a little bit, and it's kind of odd. Why do you think that is?
But the inverse between the gold and silver, or gold and the dollar?
Gold and silver. So usually when the dollar,
I hadn't noticed that. I mean, I was with silver down today. I did not notice. And gold was up.
Actually, silver was up today, but the last couple of days silver went down. And
they generally move in the same direction. Silver is more of an industrial metal than gold is. Gold functions as money, pure and simple. Silver tends to go up and down with the economy a little bit more. When there's economic fear that industry is going to slow down, silver is used for a variety of products that industry uses. So there's that lessens the demand for silver. So that's why silver is more volatile and more exposed to the business cycle than gold is. But I didn't notice where the price was today.
I think it ended at like about 18, a little bit over 18 today, 18.09 or something.
Yeah, a little over 18. That's a pretty good price. I mean, that's the biggest price. That's the highest price in almost 2 years. If it's up over 18, that's good news for silver. And some of the silver, I did know some of the silver stocks were up today, pretty impressively. So but still, remember the inflation adjusted high for silver is $50.
Right. My last question is, and this might be a silly question, but I was kind of wondering, does our military power in the world, does that help us maintain other countries keeping our dollar at a current value?
I would think so. I mean, certainly the military power exudes power. People think we're the strongest, even if our economy seems to implode from within. You still project the power abroad. And that props us up. Eventually, we won't be able to maintain that anymore. It becomes more of a hindrance than a help. But yes, it certainly does. I think it's perception is reality, and that's a lot of perception. Aircraft carriers a lot of perception. expensive perception. Anyway, let's go to Mike of our file. We've got about 2 minutes left. Mike in D.C., thanks for holding.
Hey, Andrew,
how you
thanks
doing?
For having me.
No problem. We've got 3 minutes. So.
All right, just a quick question, follow-up on the general market. I just got a question because he was talking about gold kind of breaking out in the short term. And yesterday, the market dropped significantly. Could be potentially a start of an intermediate correction. But at the same time, oil dropped with the market while gold went up. I was wondering from a fundamental perspective what your opinion is in terms of the correlation between oil and general stocks versus gold and general stocks, and at what point will we see if oil is correlated to the stock market, do we need to see a yuan appreciation for oil to become decoupled? Or I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the whole relationship.
Well, yeah, oil, both oil and gold are sensitive to dollar movements, obviously. But oil is generally healthier. But, you know, when the recession, the demand for oil is going to fall. You know, there's the demand for gold doesn't fall. So gold is more monetized, and it's, you know, it's gold and should be more oil and silver should be more correlated than gold. But I do think that, you know, there's still plenty of demand for oil, even, you know, with even if the recession is, you know, the economic growth isn't as robust as it was 5 years ago, there's still plenty of demand for oil. The production hasn't increased that much. Demand has. Oil oil is very much a function of the dollar, since it is quoted in dollars around the world. When there's inflation here, when there's a lot of monetary expansion here, that's going to show up in gold, because oil is essentially used like money to a certain extent. So in that sense, gold and oil are more aligned. I know my answer is very muddled here, but
that makes sense.
Best I can do. I mean, I think. You know, oil is certainly a if you look at the oil chart, you know, just like gold is. I mean, I think anyone who says that the floor for oil is not 75 or 80 bucks, you know, I think that's the floor. You know, 75 is the new 50. Maybe we spiked up to 125 a couple of years ago. Maybe the spikes are those days are gone. But it's we're going to be dealing with expensive oil. Anyway, looks like I got 30 more seconds here. Do you have any other question? Not that I can answer in 30 seconds.
I also had a question about the China real estate, but we touched on that, so thank you.
Okay. Okay, so we'll leave it there. Thanks for your call, Mike. This is Andrew Schiff, Europe Pacific Capital, signing off. Don't forget how an economy grows and why it crashes. Look for it in bookstores in about a week. Ask your bookseller there. Order a copy. Let's get it to number one, people. We're almost there. Only 9 more spaces. How an economy grows and why it crashes. Andrew Schiff signing off. Bye-bye.